please. Okay, everybody, welcome to our spring council meeting here in Mystic. Can everybody hear me? How about now? So-so? How about now?
Move up.
How about now?
Can you hear me now?
Is that any better? How about now? Okay, thank you. I'd like to start the meeting off before we get into the agenda and the formal part of the meeting. Just like to pay special recognition. The council community and the fishing industry lost two people since our last meeting, and I wanted to ask for a moment of silence for both of them. Longtime fisheries economist and SSC member John Gates passed away since our last council meeting. And we also lost Peter Prybot, who many of you have known over the years. Attended just about every council meeting. He was also a lobsterman up in Gloucester. He was lost not too long ago as well, so I ask for a moment of silence. Thank you. Just remind everybody to please silence your cell phones. And as a normal course of action, I like to take a break roughly every 90 minutes to 2 hours. So to the council members, please try to stay in your seats and engaged in the agenda. And know that I'll be looking for a break every 90 minutes to 2 hours. Also, please put your cell phones on vibrate or turn your ringers off. Any suggestions for additions or changes to the agenda as written? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, thank you, John. We'll be receiving a report from the regional administrator today regarding Framework 22 for sea scallops. We'll hear, I believe, under the open period for public comments, some concerns and a request from at least a large segment of the sea scallop industry. I suspect that will prompt the council to deal with that particular issue. So I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps early Thursday morning, some time could be set aside for discussion of a possible action on sea scallops. that would perhaps, if it's appropriate for you, your timing, precede the management area coordination agenda item. And I say that because Deirdre will be here on that morning to deal with that particular agenda item. Consequently, if we discuss scallops as well, we'll have the benefit of her understanding of the issue.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Pierce. I think that makes sense. I'll put a notation on the agenda for Thursday. Anything else? Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Tuesday afternoon agenda, there's a Habitat Committee report and an overview of the impacts of the SASE model as related to the Habitat report. And I would suggest that we reverse the order so we have the review prior to the Habitat report. Four and 4:30.
Is there any objection? Okay. We'll do that. Thanks, Terry. Anything else? Okay. Pat?
Just two quick things. I wanted to remind the council that we are online. The council meeting will be broadcast online today. If your mic is on and you're whispering to your pal next to you, you will be heard. Well, you will be heard by everyone listening in. So be sure your mic is off if you don't want your sidebar conversations heard. But we will be broadcasting the entire meeting for the 3 days. The other issue is, would you allow me to check with Pat Sullivan, who's here from Ithaca and Cornell, to give the Habitat report, just to see time, talk about timing for a few minutes, and then we can get back to you about making that change to the Habitat agenda items. Okay, thanks.
Okay, back on agenda. First agenda item, report on recent activities, council chair's report. I'll direct your attention to tab 1, document number 7. Executive committee met on April 5th. Again, document number 7 behind tab number 1. The executive committee reviewed timelines and management actions, which are contained behind tab number 1 for your information. You can see those. We met with PDT chair and council staff member Lori Steele concerning Herring Amendment 5. There's an issue or two that's going to come back to the council concerning a motion we made at the last council meeting relative to a motion which asked to include an option for weighing of all fish. So the PDT had some questions for clarification for the council, so that'll be coming back up. We also discussed the catch share workshop planning and had a series of discussions around that. As you can see, we decided to not put in stone a date for the catch share workshop at this point, and the executive committee suggests to the council that we wait until we received the report on sectors, which we expect to get, I think, a 9 or 10 month report at the June council meeting, and then make a decision from there as to what type of a workshop we would put together later in the calendar year. We had discussions about the Interior Department Wind Energy Initiative. We talked about BOMER, NROC, National Ocean Service. Specifically talking about offshore wind development, wind farm development, and the RFI below the islands, as well as what, if any, role the Habitat Omnibus, which has been under development for several years, could play in that. We did have a discussion about potentially splitting Phase 1 and Phase 2 to get the EFH and HAPCs on the books, but was determined that was a decision we had made long ago not to split them, and we're going to stay the course. That's our recommendation. We reviewed the possibility of having a July council meeting to review first-year sector operations for various logistical reasons. Setting a meeting in July to review sector operations is not feasible. Most of the data won't be available, and it was decided that a better time would be later in the year, perhaps September or October, to have a more meaningful review of what did happen with the sectors. We also said that in discussion that the general catch-share workshop as envisioned by the council may best be replaced by or supplemented by a more dedicated and deliberate review of sectors instead of a more generic discussion of catch shares. We had a brief discussion on the Groundfish Committee's recommendation to delay work on accumulation limits. We were informed that the Groundfish Committee would recommend a delay in the development until a time certain. And our staff member suggested a serial sector review starting with a 9-month report in June, followed by the sector annual report, would be a good starting point to have that discussion. Pat Fiorelli made us aware that Ingrid Biedren, who's, I believe, under Dr. Sullivan, there's Ingrid right there. Hi, Ingrid. We'll be conducting a survey of attitudes concerning ecosystem-based management. And I committed or agreed to mention her today. I think she'll be in touch with council staff, council members, and perhaps members of the public. Or if members of the public are here today and want to talk with Ingrid, I'm sure she'd love to hear your feelings on ecosystem-based fisheries management. We confirmed the SSC officers as nominated by the SSC. We approved terms of reference for Skates and Whiting. And then the executive committee went into an executive session. Any questions? David Gith.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I assume sometime during that executive committee meeting you had discussed writing letters to the editor. It's not in the document. Was that...
I don't recall doing that, David. I just checked with Paul. If any other member of the executive committee has a different memory, please correct me.
Okay, well, what I'm concerned with is that somewhere the executive committee decided to be writing letters, apparently, because we're, you know, received copies of letters that the second one was signed by the members of the executive committee. Was that done offline or not at the executive committee then? Or I'm just a little concerned as to how these came about.
I believe that stems back from a meeting we had as an executive committee in Newburyport. I think it would probably was right around the start of the fishing year last year, where we were saying that we were concerned about the negative press that was going on, and we wanted to have a strategy as to how to respond to things when things were reported inaccurately, and we wanted to have a communication strategy for that. And then I think individual members on the executive committee brought erroneous claims that were printed to the attention of the executive committee, and decision was made to refute some of those claims.
Okay, well, I would suggest that this concerns me, and I don't see it in it. I brought the operations plan with me. I don't see it as a duty listed to the executive committee, and you know, I'm concerned that the executive committee is tasking the staff to respond to comments in the press, and I'm concerned that these responses are not necessarily related to factual errors, but appear to be attempts to reshape readers' views of council actions that have often deeply divided the council, and on which the full council may not concur. I am concerned this is changing the staff role from one of neutral gathering of facts and production of documents to one of defending council actions. I think if the executive committee or any individuals wish to respond to articles in the press, that is their right. They should write their own letters, and I think they should sign them as individuals, even as groups of individuals, but not on behalf of the council. I think if there are factual errors, we have a press person already, Pat Fiorelli. A factual error to me is somebody says there's 3,000 tons of a quota when it's really 4. That can be dealt with relatively quickly. But when it gets into policy, I think that's beyond the purview of people to comment on behalf of the council. So I'm hoping that in the future, if we are going to do this, that we at least consult the entire council and make sure they concur with the letter before it goes out. But I'd really prefer to have people write their own letters. I write my own. I don't sign them as the New England Fisheries Management Council. I sign them as myself, with Fish and Vessel, Ellen Diane. And I think that's the proper way to do this. So I just wanted to call it to your attention that at least some people are concerned with this change in policy.
Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to clarify, the last executive committee meeting, there was not discussion about any potential press responses. The latest flurry of stuff in the press came out very shortly after that meeting. There was some email that went back and forth, and I think some ideas were shared with staff about how to gauge who supports and who does not support potential public statements. So I don't know, you know, Pat and I had a little back and forth on just some ideas for some protocol to make sure that people are okay with having either their name or the executive committee or the chair, if it's just his name, on a letter so that it's crystal clear who is supporting a public position that might be in the form of a letter to the editor and who is not. I don't know if Pat wanted to speak to the protocol, because I mean it certainly is important for the council to be able to clarify positions that the council as a body has taken, and for the council to be able to be on record and correct the record if it needs to be corrected. So I don't know, Pat, if you have anything to add in terms of how the council is going to be making sure that it's clear whose name is going on things and that those individuals have given their consent.
It's a bit of a difficult thing to comment on, because there are so many different circumstances that the council, I think, would like to respond to. So I would suggest that maybe we develop some sort of perhaps guidelines, because everything is different, and also press responses have to be done in a timely fashion. Otherwise, we can spend hours crafting a lovely reply, but if it's too late, or if the paper simply chooses not to do it, not publish it, it's time wasted. So there are a number of different issues that come up. Generally, when the staff puts together a response, we try to be factual. We try to reflect the decisions of the council. And we will check, maybe if we write up some guidance, maybe what we need to do is put that out to the council and see what kind of circumstances you all think would be representative of how you feel, what types of letters we should respond to, and what we ought to say as general guidance.
Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I always felt, and I would need some guidance if this isn't true, that if the council votes on something and it's approved 9-8, then I would say the council said this, or the council believes this, or something like that. Because the majority of the council favored something, then I would speak for the council on what they approved. Now, I can see where almost half of the council wouldn't agree to that, but I think that's what we buy into by majority vote carries the day. So that's the way I've been operating, that if the council votes on something, it's nearly never unanimous. But if the council votes on it, then I would speak for the council voted on it for these reasons or something like that.
Pat.
Well, that was part of my point. The council does take a vote and does does take a position, does make a decision. And it's, I think it's perfectly appropriate for the council to provide information on that decision and to explain that decision. In fact, I think it's more than appropriate. I think the council has an obligation to do that. Pat's idea of providing some guidance to the staff, because the staff shouldn't be caught in the middle in this. The staff is only on behalf of the council explaining what the council did. So I think guidance is a good idea in a subsequent council discussion.
Anyone else? Rip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, I know that there has been some concern expressed by several of the council members concerning this, but it seems to me that since this is now a discussion item, if people feel that the executive committee does not have the authority to make the kind of response that we have and doing it on behalf of the executive committee, I think that's something we should get resolved here and now. I think Pat's correct in that in order to respond to some of these things where there are facts that are printed that are incorrect, we need to be able to do it in some sort of very timely fashion. And if I just don't think it's possible to craft something, get it approved by everybody on the council, and have it done in any sort of reasonably timely fashion.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I agree. I think it's a something that Pat's suggestion that we have a white paper, we have a discussion about this at a future meeting. Just, and if there's questions about whether we, the executive committee or the council staff, is going to develop these responses to provide factual input, I think that needs to be outlined in our policy for the executive committee, or some kind of policy for what staff responsibilities are. Just so it's clear that when to all council members that where these letters would come from and who would have the final say on them.
Mr. Libby.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I appreciated the effort. Didn't have any problem with what was said, and don't have any problem if it happens again. Thank you.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think guidelines would be perfectly fine if it makes people more comfortable, but I don't think we should ever place the council staff or the executive committee in a situation where anything that goes out the door is going to be a consensus statement by the council. I think that Paul's interpretation of the council speaking by a majority vote is the only way that we're ever going to be able to make any statements about anything. And I've certainly been on the losing side of a vote and seen a press release go out that I didn't think was the greatest thing in the world and didn't agree with it. But that's the process, and that's, I think we need to stick with that.
Dave Prebble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a new problem, and the answers that people are coming up with here are not new. And by not new, I mean it goes back to the very beginning of the nation. The actions of a yellow, scurrilous press are nothing new. And the exact same things that are being said around the table here have been said for over 200 years in facing this problem. And what it ultimately winds up is either you accept the loss by not responding, or you respond in the way that Paul has described. And I agree with Dave Gaethel on principle, but the people that have been attacking us are unprincipled. And we need to, not all, I'm not talking about legitimate attacks, I'm talking about the ones that are just merely scurrilous. And the council has to be able to respond to that. So I think that the majority opinion here seems to be that what has been done so far is within what the council should be doing, and I agree with it. I think that what went out was long past due.
Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Paul's interpretation of it. That's what makes this process so dynamic. We may all disagree, but at the end of the day, it's the final result that goes out, and we all have to stand by it. There's plenty of times that I've been on the other side of the vote, but that's what makes this so, it's a good process. So the majority should speak for the council. Thank you.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I too believe it's a responsibility of the council to respond and follow up to the issues that we do business with at these meetings. But I hear discomfort from some of our members, and I'd suggest that between now and our June meeting, we come up with some general guidelines and come back to the council in June and move this ahead and continue to respond to the press as on an as-needed basis.
Okay, I think we're done with this for now. We'll come back to it in June. We'll have a white paper to review and have a discussion. Sally?
Yeah, this is another question related to the executive committee report, a different topic. Item number 7, the first-year sector operations review. So the discussion was the executive committee and others, I'm sure, want to have a review as soon as possible. But as you stated in your summary of that meeting, it seems like the realistic time frame is more in the range of September, which seems like it's a long time from now. And understanding that there needs to be time for sectors to balance the books after the end of the fishing year, concluding next week, and a time for NIMS to reconcile their books. I guess my question is to NIMS, is there any way to potentially bump up a first-year review of sector operations any earlier than September? Because certainly, you know, I think everyone is going to be anxious to really get a good handle on year one.
I'm going to start because Frank's mouth is full. I think the timing is very difficult. Remember, at the council's request, we allowed extra time this year for the sectors and everyone to balance their books. And so that's going to happen through June. The sector reports won't be available until July. And then, of course, once everyone balanced the books, we need to reconcile all of that with the sectors. So I really think that this year it's important for us to take the time to make sure that everyone agrees with the information, that the data is properly reconciled before we start pumping out reports. So,
and I also think that the nine-month report that will be coming out very shortly, there will be analyses in there that will be expanded upon in the annual report. However, the format and the mechanism for doing those analyses is pretty much set now, unless there are minor changes. So I think that once the data are reconciled and the sector landings are reconciled, the actual analyses will go rather quickly. But I don't think that it's going to be possible to do anything before, say, August. So moving the actual discussion about it to September seems that's pretty much the shortest time frame that we have.
Would seem to me, for a future decision, perhaps to shorten the window of time for this annual report from each sector to 30 days would make sense. You're supposed to be keeping track of this stuff all along. If you can't get it written in 30 days, I'd be surprised. Anything else on the executive committee report? Okay. Moving on, executive director, Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just two quick things. You all might know Jess Megley. Staff worked for Deirdre on scallops for about 18 months, and most recently for Tom Neese on groundfish. She's offered her resignation. She'll be taking a job with Norman Associates in Portsmouth. She did a great job for us, and we'll miss her, but this new job is more akin to her analytical skills and less policy, so she's very excited about that, and we wish her well, and she should be here one of these 3 days if you want to say goodbye to her. Budget. The budget was passed. We were very afraid that we may get a budget down to the 2008 level, which for us would have been a third of our current budget. I've hired four people since 2008. However, the most recent budget news that I do get is that our budget will be reduced approximately 10%, which is only tentative because next week John Rip and I are going to Charleston, South Carolina to compete for that 10% or so reduction on the full council budget. So we'll know more about our budget for 2010 after next week's council coordination committee meeting. The news is, though, that this year wasn't too bad, but stand by for 2012, that 2012 will be the year that it's really bad. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Okay, moving on. Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. National Fisheries Service published an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register on April 21st. Take this out so I can speak into the microphone. To revise National Standard 10, which is the Safety of Life at Sea guidelines. It's requesting public comment on potential adjustments to the guidelines through July 20th of this year. There will be a public meeting on the ANPR on May 19th at the NOAA Science Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And the agency is also considering holding additional public meetings regionally, but those have not been announced yet. On multi-species, we did the final rule to approve the sector operations plans for fishing year 2011 was published April 25th. Measures will be effective May 1st. The action implements 19 sectors for the 2011 fishing year. At the request of the sectors, we also approved 17 exemptions from the regulatory requirements. Currently, we have a total of 836 permits enrolled in sectors for fishing year 2011. That represents 58% of the multi-species permits and accounts for almost 99% of the historical fishing effort. Of course, vessels have until April 30 to withdraw from sectors and join the common pool. In addition, we're also allowing a limited opportunity for changes to the sector rosters to accommodate permit holders who took ownership of their permits after the December 1 roster deadline. And so, of course, we won't have a final count of the number of vessels and which sector they're in until after the start of the fishing year. Framework 45. Final rule was published on April 25th and, again, effective on May 1st. All the measures, with the exception of one, were approved. We did disapprove the measure that would have shifted responsibility for the at-sea monitoring coverage payments from the fishing industry to the agency due to the inability to count on federal funding for that. So beginning in 2012, the requirement is still in place for the industry to assume responsibility. Of course, if NOAA has funding available, we will, to the extent that we can, continue to try to cover both the dockside monitoring and at-sea monitoring. At the request of the council, at the last council meeting, if you recall, there was a vote to establish an accumulation limit control date. That limit was established, that control date, sorry, was published in the Federal Register and established for April 7th of this year. We took recently, on April 5th, several actions in the common pool fishery. We published an adjustment to the trip limits that will be effective through April 30, increasing the trip limit for common pool vessels for Georges Bank cod, Cape cod, Gulf of Maine and Southern New England, yellowtail flounder. In addition, we reduced the common pool trip limits for Gulf of Maine cod and Gulf of Maine winter flounder. As of April 16th in the common pool, we were at just slightly over 100% of the ACL for Gulf of Maine winter flounder, and we were at 127% of the ACL for witch flounder. All of the others were under, continue to be under the ACL. For our days at sea and a summary leasing report for the period May 1, 2010 through April 22, 2011, total leases processed for the common pool 54, for sectors 175. Total leases approved 47 in the common pool, 133 for sectors. That represented 56 distinct permits from the common pool, 186 for sectors. Total days at sea leased 614.9 common pool, 3,892.2 sectors. And that's that. And ACE transfers, I'm not going to go through species by species, but through the same date, we had over 15.5 million pounds that had been transferred through over, 961 different transfers. Moving on to sea scallops, a notice of availability for Amendment 15 to the Atlantic Sea Scallop Fishery Management Plan was published on March 24th. A proposed rule was published on April 11th. The comment period on the amendment closes May 23rd, and the comment period on the proposed rule closes May 26th. Amendment 15 includes ACLs along with other measures. Spiny dogfish specifications. The proposed rule for the spiny dogfish specifications published in the Federal Register on March 17th. The comment period closed on April 18th. And the final rule on that is pending. The proposed rule proposed an increase in the quota from 15 million to 20 million pounds for fishing year 2011. And then we did have a Northeast Region Coordinating Council meeting this April 6th and 7th. There's a few agenda items that may be of interest to the council. The NRCC, in particular, there were three action items associated with, four action items associated with three general areas that I just briefly mentioned. The NRCC did consider the issue of vessel baselines in each of our fisheries and upgrade provisions in our fisheries, and decided that it may be a good time to relook at those requirements across the two councils, across New England and the Mid-Atlantic Council, because, of course, we have consistent requirements for all of the fisheries to, number one, sort of determine whether or not they are still appropriate in all of the fisheries we have, but maybe more importantly, to see if there's any way to potentially streamline them, make them less burdensome, and to look at whether or not they're actually achieving the goals that we laid out when we put those measures in place many years ago now. And so there's a work group that will be reporting back to the NRCC at their fall meeting on this, and then eventually it will come back to the councils. The second thing that I would just mention is it is time to compile the three-year report on the SBRM, and I know Paul Rago's in the agenda for tomorrow, I think it is, to talk about this, so we won't spend a lot of time on it. He will talk about the three-year report and what's in it, and and what the plan is, but the NRCC did agree to a working group that will be working on that again into this fall. And then finally, we've also been working through the NRCC on a transition plan for implementation of a new assessment process, hopefully beginning sometime around 2013. The NRCC has agreed sort of conceptually with moving forward with this transition plan. We've been working on developing a new process for assessments. The NRCC has agreed to move forward with a transition plan that, again, they'll consider at the fall meeting, and it will come to the council shortly after that. And I think those were the important NRCC agenda items. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Pat. Paul Howard?
Just for everyone's information, and Pat, I contacted Silver Spring, Emily Manassas, and she's tentatively agreed to hold a session on the National Standard 10 Notice of Proposed Rulemaking and take some public comments at our June council meeting. So we're looking forward to that.
All right, Terry Stockwell, then Doug Grout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Pat. Are you able to provide an update on the status of the Redfish EFP application for the Gulf of Maine? We've got staff and industry on standby right now.
I'm sorry. I'll have to check into it and get back.
Okay, thanks.
Pat, in one of the groundfish reports, there was a comment asking about whether trying to deal with the common pool trip limits are adjusted, and their other mechanism is differential days at sea. And there was a suggestion that maybe that there should be more adjustments to the differential days at sea and allow higher trip limits to make the common pool more efficient at catching their catches. Is there any thoughts about going in that direction for 2011?
If the council thinks that's a better way to approach some of these adjustments, we can certainly look at it.
So you'd like guidance from the council to go one way or the other, discussion and guidance?
I think it would be helpful if maybe as part of our review of the management program, we could talk a little bit about the common pool. It's turned out to be a much smaller number of vessels than we expected that are actually fishing, and a much smaller number of vessels that represent the majority of the catch. Certainly, right now, it's I think, you know, resource-wise, it's taking a disproportionately high amount of resources to monitor and monitor it effectively and to make the adjustments. So I do think it would be worthwhile to have a discussion about how we can improve it for the few vessels that remain in the common pool and potentially maybe reduce the burden and the uncertainty for all of us.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Pat, the service has published the interim final rule, request for comments on the 2011 sector operations plans and contracts, and inside that Federal Register announcement, there's a description of the service's decision not to accept the exception for the rule trawl, the smaller version of the rule trawl, the separate haddock separator trawl. I had hoped that that would have been approved in light of the fact that many vessels apparently don't have the horsepower necessary to fish the larger net, the regular rule trawl. But I see that the decision of the service was based on a March 16 Research Steering Committee meeting where it reports, that is in the Federal Register announcement, that the RSC, the Research Steering Committee, determined that the statistical analyses presented was not appropriate to measure the performance of this gear against the control and requested additional statistical analysis of the results before continuing their review of the study. My question is, and I guess David Gethel might be able to weigh in on this, and I recognize that we'll address this during the Research Steering Committee report, which I think is tomorrow, is that is the conclusion of the RSC, that indeed the two papers, the two studies that were done were not definitive, did not provide enough information to justify the approval of that smaller version of the rule trawl for use in the fishery. Were there any other reasons leading to the rejection of that rural trawl besides reduced rural trawl, besides that particular Research Steering Committee recommendation? And indeed, is that the recommendation of the Research Steering Committee, that it's not a net that can be used?
So that's my understanding, but David may be able to help with that part of it. With respect to your question about is that the only reason, we have been looking for the information that we need, that we feel we need to approve this alternative rule trawl. As you know, the original went through extensive testing. We have a process in the regulations for approving alternative gears in different situations that requires that effectively we have the scientifically valid testing protocol before we can move forward. So we're it's if we have the information, then we're happy to move forward with approval.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, before you go to David, I guess I. The language in the Federal Register, when compared with the text in the Research Steering Committee report, is a bit confusing in that it sounded to me that with further statistical analyses of the data that was presented to the Research Steering Committee, there may eventually be, maybe even in the near term, a decision that indeed it is a trawl that could be used, that it does pass the test, so to speak, that all the statistics prove that indeed it does accomplish what we would like it to accomplish. So when David responds, I'd also like to know if indeed I'm correct in my interpretation, that is, they're waiting for new statistical analyses, and if indeed that analysis shows that it should be approved, would the service be in a position to revisit this issue and actually approve the exemption sometime during the fishing year?
Dave Gethel?
Yes. Well, everybody's correct so far. As of March 16th, we did not have sufficient statistical analysis to be able to recommend the trawl for approval. Subsequent to that, the PIs went back and did some more statistical analysis. We held another Research Steering Committee meeting. They provided the new analysis, and several other scientists, including one from your staff, Mike Pohl, provided analysis of the information they had provided. And at the end of that meeting, we did approve the 250 by 40 eliminator trawl to be moved forward by the most expeditious means possible for use. So I guess as of when the Federal Register notice was published, that was the status of things, but it has changed subsequent to that.
I think all I can tell you at this point, David, is we'll look at it.
That's a good response. Thank you. And what other question relates to scallops? And you report in your document, you reported that Amendment 15 is in the works and it's moving forward. Could you provide us with a bit of explanation? Well, not explanation. What's the status of Framework 22? On scallops, because I realize, and I've been told after talking with Deirdre and other individuals, that there are some implications relative to the delay in implementation of that framework.
We expect Framework 22 very shortly. And I'm sorry, I missed your last comment.
Has there been a delay in the implementation, the expected implementation of that framework? And has the service given any consideration to the implications of that delay for scallop management, some implications that the council should be made aware of?
So Framework 22 actually depends on Amendment 15 being implemented, which has not happened. None of this is unexpected. When the council took action, we knew that the timeline for both of them and that we would be in a situation of roughly implementing the framework and Amendment 15 approximately the July time period. So it's nothing changed.
All right, thank you. The framework is tied to the amendment. The amendment will soon be implemented. Consequently, there's an understandable and expected delay in implementation of the framework. During the public comment period, I believe, as I indicated earlier, someone or some individuals will actually address this issue and request some specific action of the council. So, thank you, Pat.
Just to be clear, I said it was an expected delay, not an unexpected delay.
That's what I meant. It was an expected delay. However, there are some considerations that this council will have to deal with, some unexpected consequences of the delay in the framework, and we will describe the nature of those unexpected consequences when we deal with scallops on Thursday morning. And once again, the expected consequences perhaps will be highlighted by those members of the public who will speak to the issue.
Any other questions for Pat? Okay, seeing none, Noah, General Counsel.
Well, the streak of one has ended in terms of council meetings without a new lawsuit. We were, the Red Sox are doing better than we are now. We have been sued in connection with Amendment 4 to the Herring Plan. A lawsuit was brought by Michael Flaherty, Alan Hasbach, and Ocean River Institute, challenging on basically four counts. The first count is that amendment, and I'm just sort of summarizing these to get the exact details. You can visit or you can read the complaint. Amendment 4 fails to include river herring and shad, a species of fish that are part of the herring fishery, and fails to establish ACLs for these species in violation of National Standards 1, 2, and 9. A second count claims that Amendment 4 ACLs are not based on best scientific information available because they were based on the interim ABC control rule in violation of National Standards 1 and 2. Third count is that Amendment 4 AMs are inadequate because they're not meaningful and in violation of National Standards 1, 2, and 9. And fourth complaint, Amendment 4 violates NEPA because it's based on an EA, not an EIS, and failed to adequately consider certain alternatives to its measures. We have 45 days under the statute to file an answer and administrative record. We may or may not be seeking an extension on that. Our new deputy regional counsel, Denise Desautel, is actually the lead attorney on this case, and I will be assisting her in preparation of our defense of this lawsuit. This lawsuit, we've filed with the court that this lawsuit has a related lawsuit, and that is the Martha's Vineyard Dukes County Fishermen's Association lawsuit that was filed, I think, back in September, challenging NIMPS, the two regional the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast New England Regional Council's failures to, and NMSA's failure to have adequate fishery management plan measures to address river herring and shad, bycatch. That lawsuit also challenged ASMFC and in terms of the federal government's not imposing or implementing regulations in the EEZ to protect river herring and shad. So those two cases are related, and there may be some future action to determine whether they should be considered by the same court, although I don't think those decisions have been made at this point in time. The Martha's Vineyard lawsuit, just to give you a very brief update, I'm not involved with that in any detail. Other attorneys in my office are. But as I understand it, there are pending motions to dismiss that lawsuit based on jurisdictional statute of limitations grounds. An update on the case challenging Amendment 11 to the Scallop FMP. As I reported, I believe, last council meeting, we had prevailed at the district court. Well, actually, I didn't report that at the last council meeting, but at that time we had won at the district court level that case. The plaintiffs had appealed the case to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. That case was argued in February, and the three-panel court upheld the district court decision that found in the government's favor in that case on all counts. Now, since then, the plaintiff has filed with the Third Circuit Court of Appeals a motion for the entire court to hear the case on grounds of its importance and of claimed failure to comply with applicable law by the three-judge panel that upheld the lower court decision. So we are waiting instructions from the Third Circuit as to whether they're going to take up the request for a hearing of the full court. That's at the discretion of that court to do that. With respect to the two lawsuits challenging Amendment 16, Groundfish Amendment 16, as I reported, would be done. All briefs have been filed and oral arguments have been held. With respect to Amendment 16, filed in Boston Federal District Court by New Bedford and Gloucester, and that case was joined with another case filed in the New Jersey Federal Courts. And we are awaiting a decision in that case. There's been no indication of when that decision will come down. In the other case filed by Oceana against the agency regarding Amendment 16, which is being tried in D.C. District Court in Washington, D.C., the plaintiffs filed their motion for summary judgment. We filed our reply and our cross motion for summary judgment. And the plaintiff has, I believe, until May 12th to file a reply to our motion for summary judgment, and then it's likely that the court would set oral arguments in that case. I think that's all I have to report about significant cases in this region, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to the next report. Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Dr. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start with some updates and news about our survey activities. As I mentioned at the last council meeting, in the last fall bottom trawl survey, we encountered large numbers of small haddock, which are likely to be age zero. And if they survive, which will before they recruit to the fishery, there's potential for a large year class coming, but they actually don't recruit to the fishery for 3 or 4 years. So just a heads up that this was detected on the fall survey. The research vessels at all of the all the NOAA vessels at the centers have experienced reductions in sea day allocations for their research vessel sea days, and a number of surveys that are done out of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center have tentatively been canceled or reduced in the number of days that the ship will be out there doing the survey. However, this is not a definite decision yet, and it's possible that some funds will be returned to the centers and there will be some reevaluation of which surveys are funded and which ones will go out. I can tell you that there are no planned reductions for sea days in the multi-species bottom trawl survey, the sea scallop dredge survey, and the clam dredge survey. So those three will happen. The dates for the upcoming surveys for the spring bottom trawl survey, that will be February the 28th to May the 12th, and that's underway. The sea scallop dredge survey will be May 11th to July the 1st. The clam dredge survey will be July the 5th till August the 12th. The northern shrimp survey will be July the 18th until August the 13th. And the herring acoustic survey is scheduled for the month of September. We also have some optical survey pilot projects, two of them, which will explore new technologies for doing surveys, one with a autonomous underwater vehicle and another one with the stereo HABCAM system. And moving on to stock assessment news, we're currently preparing for SARC 52, which will take place in Woods Hole from June the 6th until the 10th. That's when the peer review will take place. The stocks that are on the agenda for benchmark assessments, peer review, will be the three winter flounder stocks, Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank, and Southern New England. We are also active with the GARM stocks, all of the multi-species groundfish. We're working with the expanded PDT to do analyses of the catch and survey data to support the work that's being done on the biennial ACLs. We also have scheduled work on the track species. There's the Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail. And we are also going to be doing this summer and into the fall the mid-Atlantic updates, the bluefish, black sea bass, scup, fluke, and dogfish. SARC 53, which will take place in late November, early December of 2011, has Gulf of Maine cod on the schedule and black sea bass. And then going towards June of 2012, SARC 54, there's Southern New England yellowtail flounder and herring on the agenda. And then again, we'll be doing the track as well as the mid-Atlantic updates. Pat Kirkle already mentioned to you that we're going through a transition to a new system that designed to produce science advice to the regional office and to the councils on a schedule that works better for everyone in a way that uses the center's resources and tries to fit in with the management schedules and so forth. So we have a large committee that has members from all of our partner organizations, and we are working quite a lot towards developing a transition plan. And this is being overseen by the NRCC. So I think in the coming year, you will be hearing more about that transition. The last point that I wanted to make is about the SAWSARC process. As you know, I think over the last few years we've agreed that the process would have independent reviewers from the Center of Independent Experts, and in addition we get a chairman who is appointed from the SSCs of our either the Mid-Atlantic Council or the New England Council. And for instance, for this SARC, Pat Sullivan, who's in the audience, will be chairing the June meeting, and he'll be the SARC chairman. In the past, we've worked out an agreement where funds for the CIE have come from one pool of money, and the funds for supporting the SSC member who chairs the SARC have been from a different pool of money. And given the funding situation that is around this year and in the coming year, there has been some uncertainty about whether that money would be available. So the center has been having some discussions with Paul Howard about that. Either way, we've lined up funds to cover Pat so he can rest easy. But I just wanted you to know that even though we think the process is working very well, having an SSC member chair the SARC, funds have to come from somewhere, and even we can't take that for granted. So we hope that that continues in the future, where we do have source funds for that purpose to support the process. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Any burning questions for Dr. Jim? David?
Yes. Jim, what's the date that the terms of reference for the SAW 53, when's the cutoff date, or when will they be available?
Yeah, SAW 53 is the one that's going to take place in December of 2011. And we've sent out the draft terms of reference to the NRCC. They've distributed those to their various committees, and the feedback that has to come back to me is due, I believe, on May the 5th. Pat, May the 5th is the deadline for returning comments on those draft terms of reference. And the comments are not to come from individuals, but through the NRCC representatives back to me.
Okay. Moving on, Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council, any reports?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mid-Atlantic Council met 2 weeks ago down in Annapolis under mackerel, squid, and butterfish. The council agreed to add an option that would, for the incidental catch caps for river herring, shad, for the amendment via framework actions for future. Under spiny dogfish, five items, RSA for the Amendment 3, essential fish habitat, year-end rollovers, coast-wide annual quota, and no seasonal geographic or other allocation, or the regional state allocation as established by Addendum 3 to the ASMFC. The fifth one was to have the FMAT explore possible actions, alternatives regarding administration solutions for the open access fishery. And that's similar to what we did in New England, I think, with groundfish and a few others, prior to getting into the moratorium, catch shares, and other things, just to see if there was a way that could be done administratively. Monkfish, I won't get into it, it's on our agenda. Under highly migratory species, the council agreed to add a new permit so that Elex boats could retain up to 15 swordfish, and also to look at exemptions in the Lalago fishery. As we all know, the U.S. is not harvesting its swordfish quota, and this was a way to help that along. The council had a listening session, first one that they've held, went on for approximately 90 minutes. had the council leadership and people from NIMS. It was live between the audience and on the internet, approximately 50 people questioning the council, just a back and forth question and answer session. And I think the overall people thought it went very well. I don't know if the family wants to speak. I think the council will be doing it again. And that's basically it.
Anything else under Mid-Atlantic? Okay, moving along. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. In the audience this morning, two blue suiters in the back, Lieutenant Hartfield and Petty Officer Fournier from our station here in New London. So welcome to them. During the period of 1 January to 25 April, we conducted 477 boardings, issued 12 fisheries violations for an observed compliance rate of 97.5%. It's a dip from last year's period, or the last reporting period, mostly resulting from a surge in violations in the Hudson Canyon closed area that I'll talk about in a minute. On the safety side, so in the same number of boardings for the same reporting period, we issued 82 safety violations for a compliance rate of 82.8% and a fairly consistent number with the past period, a slight dip. During that time, we responded to 49 vessel casualties, 10 medevacs, and issued 12 vessel terminations with 106 lives saved and 2 lives lost. And apologize for the slide. It's not as clear as I'd hope, but these are depict three violations that we've issued in the Hudson Canyon closed area in February and March. These three significant violations were issued in cooperation with NOAA law enforcement in the Hudson Canyon closed area in the vicinity. Two of the cases occurred on February 24th, the two at the top of the closed area. The ones denoted by the green and black lettering, both were declared to fish inside the elephant trunk access area and were sighted and videotaped by Coast Guard aircraft fishing prior to entering the elephant trunk access area, and one of them, was observed with gear in the water in the Hudson Canyon access area, the one in the black letter. On March 2nd, a third limited access scallop vessel, the vessel indicated with the red and orange lettering in the southeast corner of the Hudson Canyon closed area, was observed. It was also declared to be fishing in the elephant trunk access area. And was operating in that area, but overnight the vessel departed the elephant trunk access area into the Hudson Canyon closed area, was boarded by the Coast Guard Cutter Elm 1.1 miles inside the Hudson Canyon closed area while engaged in fishing. So this activity, combined with some activity that Special Agent Donovan is going to brief you on shortly, with respect to overages in the general category fleet, shows a trend towards a lack of compliance in both the limited access and general category fleets. These cases, I'd like to point out, were not for the some significant and extraordinary efforts by Special Agent Donovan and Bill Semrau's staff uncovering these violations. They wouldn't have been possible, and the fishing vessels that were issued the violations would probably be continued to damage the scallop resource and gain an unfair competitive advantage over the vast majority of honest fishermen playing by the rules. So I'm extremely grateful for their dedication and professionalism. So that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
I think we'll go right into NIMS Enforcement and VMS. Thanks, Captain.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Council. Just to follow up with Captain DeCola, on top of those three New Bedford vessels, there was just over a week ago, another boat in New Bedford had their catch seized. Total of over 1,000 pounds of scallops were found on the vessel. Some bags were hidden in an ice, and others were hidden under several tons of ice. And earlier, later last week, down in Shinnecock, New York, Another vessel was boarded just on a routine inspection of the ports. Scallop overage. At that point, 529 pounds was abandoned to NOAA, and that's another ongoing case. The captain's right. We have seen an increase in activity, and between ourselves, our partners with Coast Guard, and the JEA, will be increasing our activity and surveillance on that fishing fleet. There was also some recent press coverage of search warrants executed down in the Virginia Beach area. I'm not at liberty to discuss too many details other than that. We do have an ongoing investigation into the charter boats illegally fishing for striped bass, and I expect more activity maybe by the next report. On other issues I want to talk about is, in the audience today is Don Fry. Don Fry is a former commercial fisherman, and he was working for the last 10 years or so with the Regional Office in Sustainable Fisheries. Don's the new Northeast Enforcement Compliance Liaison position. We had started off with a TDY program with Don Mason. We understood that it looks like it's going to be an effective program, and so we've hired Don full-time to work with OLE in the industry as our liaison to both to improve communication and to improve compliance. So I do encourage you all to, if you get a chance, Don will be here today to introduce yourselves. We're looking for feedback and interest in how the program is working and ways that we can better change our image to do a better job in enforcing, but also to, as the IG had recommended, to improve our communication and compliance. So I'm glad Don's on board and looking forward to the activity he has. Next to him is Sheila Jarns, our contract outreach specialist. She'll be working with Don and specifically working at our outreach efforts. And one of them was a recent joint product with the regional office. They were able to put together 500 vessel operating guides for the sector boats, and they're in the process of distributing those guides right now. And what I'm hoping for is some feedback from the fleet on those, and if they're effective and it's something that is worthwhile, we'll try to continue to do that with the other fishery programs. The Special Master is completing his second round of review of cases that are open until May 6th. So the early report has been submitted to Secretary Locke, and at this point I haven't seen the report. I'm not sure if it's left Secretary Locke's office. So I expect by the next meeting or even sooner we'll have an idea what the Special Master found in his first review. And lastly, I want to just reference that we should this summer have a new director in the Office of Enforcement. That concludes my report, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Council members. I'm Bill Semro, Northeast BMS Program Manager. The Northeast BMS team is monitoring 1,087 active vessels. And I want to thank Captain DeCola for those kind words. I do have my own personal concern about the non-compliance in the Hudson Canyon. That's something we're paying close attention to. There is a new VMS software change that's being sent to the Northeast VMS fleet to be used for trips commencing on or after May 1st. The change reflects both approved regulatory actions for May 1 and as well as rulemaking currently under development. A permit holder letter tailored to the vessel owner's installed VMS, whether they have a SkyMate, a Botrax, or a Tron unit, was mailed within the past 2 weeks. The letter provides detailed instructions for using the new VMS declarations and form screens to help owners comply with all reporting requirements. And that's really our goal on the team, is to help help owners understand the requirements and report correctly. For the benefit of those industry members that are listening, SkyMate mailed their CDs with the new client software on April the 12th, and the permit holder letter, which I drafted, followed on April the 13th. The new SkyMate software is version 3.936. I am getting word that owners have yet to receive the CDs, and that concerns me. This was a pattern last year. I hope to avoid that this year. It's been, 14 days now, and owners are not getting their CDs. But I do want to tell folks that there is an alternative means to get the software. If they go onto the SkyMate website at skymate.com and check the downloads page, they can download that software and burn it to a disk and install it that way. Botrax will upload their new macros to the network this Friday, April 29th, starting at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Of course, that's 8:30 a.m. their time, over an approximate four-hour window. The permit holder letter was sent on April the 19th. The new Botrax macros are Vessel Activity Reports version 13 and Forms version 7. And finally, GMPCS is scheduled to perform an over-the-air software upgrade for their for the Tron VMS units on Thursday, April the 28th. The permit holder letter was mailed on April the 20th, and GMPCS advised me that they were calling each of the Northeast customers to give them a heads up on the OTA or over-the-air schedule. The new Tron software is Trip Declaration version 9 and Reports version 9. All three permit holder letters are posted to the Northeast VMS webpage. And I did the drafting of these letters different than last year. Last year, one letter went out for Amendment 16 VMS changes, and it covered all three vendors. I thought for the benefit of the industry, I would send three separate letters and tailor it to that individual owner's hardware. So a SkyMate owner will get the SkyMate letter. The majority of it is the attachment with instructions on how to use the new software in some detail. We recently provided WebEx training on the new VMS software to the groundfish sector managers, and we also provided that training to the NIMS port agents. I do plan to record three short 20 to 30 minute training DVDs later this week and make these vendor specific tools available through the NERO website. new subject regarding Botrax units. We are working with Botrax to get the word out about replacement of older model VMS units being operated in the fleet. Now, there are about 200 of the two-piece and three-piece Botrax units that use non-GPS technology for position reporting. At the time, those units met the Northeast requirements. However, those requirements have since changed and require accuracy that GPS provides. While these units may continue to be used for the time being, they will reach a point at which they must be replaced with the newer technology. When one of these older Botrax units reaches the end of its service life, it will require replacement vice repair. And of these 200 units, there are about 20 that can no longer accommodate any future software changes because they've reached the unit's capacity. In both cases, owners who replace these older units may be eligible for the VMS reimbursement program. So I would encourage owners to contact Botrax to determine the status of their unit. Information about the reimbursement program is available on the Northeast VMS webpage or by calling the OLE's VMS help desk at toll-free 1-888-219-9228. NIMS OLE and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, Bureau of Marine Resources, are coordinating a VMS pilot program to evaluate the integration of the state's new VMS program for the surf clam industry with the existing federal VMS program. In addition to examining the technical, regulatory, law enforcement, and legal issues, the pilot program will also provide insight into the analysis of perhaps a larger scale program involving the states and federal VMS reporting. Finally, the VMS team participated in the first two Fishery Information Center outreach events, which were held in Seabrook and Eastham. We appreciate the opportunity to partner with the regional office staff and talk face-to-face with industry members who have VMS questions and concerns. That completes my report, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the Coast Guard, enforcement, or VMS? Mary Beth?
Just one quick VMS question. When you say older units, how old?
I can't exactly put a date on it, but we're talking all the three-piece units, first of all. I imagine they would know if they have a three-piece unit. Three-piece unit meaning the antenna, the black box or communications unit, and the terminal. You know, the message terminal. So that's a three-piece unit. That's an older unit using Casper technology, QASPR, which is a Qualcomm satellite triangulation, non-GPS. The two-piece unit, which is the three-piece is the MCT. The two-piece is the IMCT, where they took the black box and they moved it into the antenna, made it a communications antenna unit. So that one might be a little more difficult to determine whether it's GPS or non-GPS. Votrax can tell from the MCT number, the unique serial number assigned to that unit. And I also have the information, too. If anybody calls the VMS team, we can tell them as well what unit they have.
Roddy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any way to notify these owners? Because a lot of them don't even know what they have. All they know is they have a Votrax.
True, that's right. And Votrax is reaching out. We wanted to give them the first opportunity, Rodney, and then I'm keeping in close touch with Patrick Sullivan there at Votrax in San Diego about that.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, Vince.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I know that you're running behind, so I'll try to go quickly here for you. The commission met last month in Alexandria, Virginia, and thank you to Captain Howard for putting the summary of that meeting in your briefing books behind tab one. It's 28 pages long, and there's a lot of information there. Let me just mention a couple things folks might be interested in. The Lobster Board decided not to send out Addendum 17, which is going to be the response to the Southern New England recruitment failure. They had initiated that addendum back in May last year, but they had a last-minute proposal come in and decided that the addendum needed more work before going out. So they'll see it again in August and perhaps take action on it. The Menhaden Board initiated an addendum to take action to increase the spawning stock biomass of Menhaden, and that was in response to the stock assessment. The stock assessment showed that fishing mortality rate is now over the threshold level, so technically we're overfishing Menhaden. On the coastal sharks and spiny dogfish, the board approved state-by-state quotas for the southern sector, and that's hopefully will end the ongoing issues that we've had in terms of seasonal availability and harvesting differences between the states. The Atlantic Striped Bass Management Board took a report from our law enforcement advisors, and I wanted to thank both Captain DeCola and Special Agent Donovan on the good work that the Coast Guard and National Marine Fisheries Service, OLE, has been doing in striped bass enforcement down off North Carolina. I was directed again to write more letters to NOAA General Counsel as well as the Coast Guard looking for stiffer penalties. Law enforcement advisors are telling us that, you know, they're doing everything they can, but until the penalties go up, then we're not going to have much of the enforcement isn't going to have much effect on compliance. And one of the things we're asking the Coast Guard to look at is considering suspension and revocation proceedings against charter boat operators that are fishing in the EZ and retaining striped bass. The rules have been in effect for 20 years now. Boats are 10 miles offshore and retaining more than two fish per person per day, so it's not a complex regulation. The Totog Management Board took action to end overfishing on Totog. The biomass is a third of what the target is, and we just had a stock assessment update showing fishing mortality rate is probably three times what this technical committee has recommended. So we're going to try to get the fishing mortality back down to the rebuilding level. And finally, the Summer Flounder Scup Black Sea Bass Board approved state-by-state recreational quotas for the black sea bass fishery. And this is just for 1 year, but it was to address perceived inequities in the allocation of the conservation measures that fish are showing up in different places. And the coast-wide system was disadvantaging certain states. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, and our next meeting is in Alexandria, Virginia, the first week in August. Happy to be here, and I'll be around all day if anybody has any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Captain. Okay. Any burning questions for Vince? Okay. I'm going to move right into the next agenda item, which is the review of EFPs behind tab 14. There's a list of them there. If you've looked over them, the staff looked over them. The deadlines for comment was before this council meeting, and I think there was a unanimous uh